I'll be back. But so is Pete. Here comes the Colonel.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very, very unexpectedly, we get... Arnold, when he's in town, likes to sneak into the studio and give us a little surprise or two. Thanks, Arnold! Yes, go back to California! And Maria, you know, go back to Maria! Oh, well, no. Bad jokes, I guess. Okay. Well, welcome back. We're the second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science. Occasionally nanotechnology, that's how we got our start. Open innovation, I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. We're going to get back to our visit with John Piper in just a minute. John, if you listen to the first half hour, he's a principal at Bering Security Risk Management Services, but he has over 30 years' experience in petrochemical and nuclear security, vulnerability analysis, and risk management. It's really pretty interesting. When we left off last time, we've been talking about the North American Electrical Reliability Corporation. It used to be Council, and they changed the name to Corporation recently. Just issued a directive which requires the total integration of cybersecurity and physical security at our power plants. And the power plants, it's kind of a fog right now how fast they're moving on this. Anyway, that is John Piper's expertise right at the moment, vulnerability analysis and risk management. We were talking to him last time, and he said it was a little complicated, but he said he knows exactly how to do it, and we had to interrupt while he was explaining that to us, so we're going to get back to talk to John, and he's going to explain it all to us. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. People tell us all the time that's their favorite part of the show, so you'll want to stick around with that. And right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's query. The fountain, of course, speaks with a lisp, so he can't say fountain of useless information. Instead, he says fountain of youthless information, but we forgive him for that. Anyway, he seems to know all, hear all, see all, and tell all, but for a price. So here we're going to toss in the coins and summon up the fountain of useless information.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Yes, of course, I see. We have awakened the spirit of the fountain, who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. That's, of course, why we threw in the coins. All right. Oh, spirit of the fountain, here's a stumper. What U.S. state startled ornithologists by making the California gull its state bird? Now, give you a hint. Mississippi, Oregon, or Utah? What U.S. state startled everybody by making the California gull its state bird? Mississippi, Oregon, or Utah? How about it, O spirit of the fountain?
I have given you my answer. Now you may tell me.
Aha, we cannot stump the spirit of the fountain, although we had to think about it just a little bit. Well, of course, one would think that the California gull, the state bird, would be California. And certainly, if not California, you know, the good guess would be Oregon. But no, the answer is Utah. Yeah, Utah. And I think it's because gulls came and ate a whole lot of locusts and stuff that was ravaging the fields and plantings of Brigham Young when he was leading the Mormons across the country, and they settled in Salt Lake City. So I think that's what you'll find out if we look in the history. Anyway, the California gull is the state bird of Utah. All right, back to our program.
Thank you.
Oh, that's always so good. Getting us back to our interview with John Piper, we get the strains of the Science News Radio Network studio band. We just love them. And I want to remind you about the IEEE 2016 International Conference on Homeland Security Technologies. It's going on May 9th through the 12th at the Westin Hotel in Waltham, Massachusetts. That's where it's usually held. This is the famous and historic International Conference on Homeland Security Technology. Key technical gaps are closely examined, and John Piper is one of the speakers at this year, and he is a guest of ours right now. As we mentioned a little earlier, the North American Electrical Reliability Corporation, it's now corporation, not council, issued a directive recently which requires the total integration of cybersecurity and physical security at our power plants. And so in order to do this, we need some vulnerability analysis, and John is a expert on that. I had figured it was probably pretty complicated. He says not quite so, but it does take a lot of integration. And so when we left at the previous half hour, John was explaining to us the intricacies of how to do it.
You know, all kinds of different issues come up in this. Mm-hmm. And it's not difficult to optimize those relationships through this process.
Okay.
And the process generally is not a big time-consuming or expensive proposition. A lot of times we go in with a two-person team, and we pair up with three or four people from the asset itself, such as engineers and maintenance and people like that. Mm-hmm. Usually our best target for team membership are mid-level, fairly senior managers,
okay,
because they understand senior management philosophy and also boots-on-the-ground issues.
Sure.
And I would say, on average, we can do a $5 billion refinery in about 7 days.
Okay.
It takes maybe a day on the front end of that to develop execution plans,
mm-hmm,
and it takes maybe another day to write the report. But that execution plan and report writing is usually a one-person effort.
Okay.
And we also have some techniques in the report where we use an algorithm to prioritize recommendations, because all recommendations are not equal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a key component for management consideration. They really want to know what the priorities are. So we applied this algorithm that was developed at the math department of the University of Pennsylvania, and that sort of indicates what the first steps would be in an implementation plan.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're going to map all that. You're going to map all this out at the IEEE Homeland Security Technology Conference. That's covering the gaps. You're going to be able to show these techniques right there on the floor when you're giving your presentation. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Good. Tell me in simple words what you know when you end your presentation. What is going to be the takeaway? What do you want the people in your audience to gain from your presentation at the Homeland Security Technology Conference?
Well, so many times, organizations do not have studied, structured, or disciplined decision processes. You know, they rely on old techniques where some manager somewhere makes a decision based on some facts. This is a multidisciplined approach that cuts across the organization horizontally. And that's where the really good stuff is. That's where you get recommendations that no one takes exception to. You're not going to get pushback. You're not going to end up in turf battles. You know, management knows that they've had their guys on the team. In fact, we welcome management people reporting back to senior managers on the results of the assessment. So, you know, they know their guys have been involved in the process. They know it's not a couple of security stovepipe dudes coming in from out of town doing something. We've, mm-hmm, we've managed to pull the people together and come out with multidisciplined decisions that are very high quality.
Are these the techniques, then, that have been used at our petrochemical plants and other nuclear plants and this sort of thing to keep us safe ever since 9/11? Or are these as ancient as Aristotle?
Actually, both. I mean, we've done over 500 risk assessments in petrochemical. I've done 125 risk assessments in food manufacturing,
mm-hmm,
using the same process. In fact, in food manufacturing, they routinely use a HAZOPS process that has the same identical matrix that came out of Los Alamos.
Okay. So we're safer because we're using these techniques, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah, and this isn't some DHS model where it's going to take you 2 years and $250,000 to do a risk assessment.
Okay.
This is fast-moving, dynamic, it's thorough, it's well-practiced. Again, all the big engineering professional societies use it, like the mechanical engineers and the chemical engineers, the nuclear guys. Now, in some cases, you have to do quantitative risk assessments because some of the changes you're trying to make are the configurations that you have to deal with in very complex engineering environments require that. So, let's say, for example, in a nuclear plant, you want to put pump 62 into a maintenance mode, and you're trying to figure out if pump 82 can compensate for the loss of 62.
Okay.
Then you're going to have to do quantitative calculations, such as mean time between failures and valve pressures and all the rest, to make sure you're okay for that maintenance thing. So, yes, you do have to use quantitative approaches sometimes, but generally you don't have to. There was a big NIST study out in the 90s on quantitative versus qualitative, and NIST concluded that qualitative was just about as good as quantitative and one-tenth the cost, and people could actually understand the end product.
Yeah. Okay.
Unlike some of the big quantitative models where you end up with a 300-page report that no one can understand.
Yeah, and won't wade through and won't read. Well, let me ask you, you know, after 9/11, everybody says, oh, it's so obvious, you know, somebody's going to commandeer an airplane and fly it into the World Trade Center. I mean, why not? I mean, it's so obvious. Would these methods have prevented that from happening had we used that with the airline industry or other industries?
Well, airline is a tough industry, and I happen to personally know two former security directors for major airlines, and they were fighting this locked cockpit problem for years. And invariably, you'd get some finance guy that steps out from behind the curtain and says, we can't afford to do that, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they could never get it across the goal line. So, and a point on 9/11, I mean, at the point of 9/11... in ExxonMobil, we had done hundreds of security risk assessments. I mean, these were well-practiced tools way before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, GAO asked me to come in and make presentations to a major government agency on this process in about 2006, 2005, in that time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the GAO, in essence, was way out in front of DHS on a lot of this stuff and was recommending this and pushing it even going back to the late 90s.
Okay.
And, you know, they just couldn't move the rock up the hill. But they recognized the problem in the late 90s with some of the decision techniques that were being used for counterterrorism.
Well, there's been so much criticism of the Department of Energy in recent years. It is kind of refreshing to know that they really have been kind of ahead of the curve. So thank you very much for bringing that to light.
Yeah, GAO and DOE were pretty much ahead of the curve on this one. And, you know, then we ended up with DHS. You know, an example there is the Chemical Security Act of 2006, where they were required to categorize various chemical industries in the United States. And they screened in 4,000 chemical companies out of probably 25,000 that were looked at. So the 4,000 had to use their techniques, even though they might have used better techniques before that. I had to use their techniques to do vulnerability assessments and develop site security plans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a time crunch on this from DHS where they mandated certain timelines. You had to use their procedures. You had to do it their way. And if you didn't, they were going to shut you down, fine you, penalize you, or sue you.
Okay.
So everybody got these 4,000 projects done. They sent them into DHS. 4 years later, a whistleblower goes to the United States Senate, a senior person from DHS, and reveals the fact that they had failed to review one single submission. So it took DHS 4 years to develop the risk management tools, and then it took them 4 years to not look at any of the results of that.
Wow, that's quite a revelation. I guess are you gonna bring that up then at the conference?
Probably.
Okay, good. Well, that's a great quote. I really appreciate that. Okay. John W. Piper, Principal, Baring Security Risk Management Services, valued speaker, very much so, at the IEEE 2016 International Conference on Homeland Security Technologies. That's going to be May 9th through the 12th in Boston, Massachusetts, the famous and historic International Conference on Homeland Security Technology Gaps. And John has given us some real good insights here on how to close those gaps. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Appreciate it, Colonel.
Appreciate you, too. Thanks a bunch.
Bye.
You know, that quote by John, I think, bears repeating about the drones. Drones were a big concern right at the moment. I don't know if they concern you, but they sure do concern a lot of the people in Homeland Security. And it's a concern to me. I mean, what happens if a drone starts spying on me in my backyard? Can I take it down with my 20-gauge? Well, I keep a 20-gauge handy. Don't know if it's a good idea, the quote that John said, and I wrote it down, he said, you have to have instantaneous decision processes. What are the rules of engagement? When are you going to start shooting? You got to sort all that out right quick, and you got to have a decision process that can't wait for a lot of approvals and other considerations. And I'm sure what he's talking about is not a drone in my backyard, but a drone that maybe is going to attack one of our power plants or an airport or transportation facilities or water distribution or something like that. Anyway, real pleasure having John on, and I would mention that he's going to be speaking at the IEEE 2016 International Conference on Homeland Security Technologies. Now, I want to remind you, that's May 9th through the 12th. At the Westin Hotel in Waltham, Massachusetts. That's Boston. This is a famous and historic international conference going on for some years, ever since 2011, as a matter of fact. It's on the Homeland Security Technology Gaps. And key technical gaps are closely examined. And, of course, drones would be a serious gap that we may have right at this particular time. If you want to know more about the Homeland Security Technology Conference, you can go to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a link, and that'll take you right to the website and give you all the information that you may want to know. Great keynote speakers this year. I'm told that Mark Borkowski is going to be there. He's the Assistant Commissioner for the Office of Technology, Innovation, and Acquisition, OTIA, they call it, with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection of the Department of Homeland Security. We hope to have Mark as a guest on this program sometime in the not-too-distant future. And Richard Vorderbruggen, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, he's with the FBI. And Steve Smith is Director of Disaster Planning and Risk Management, U.S. Small Business Administration. Also, as I understand from our contacts at the Department of Homeland Security, that Dave Masters is going to speak on border security, and Ann Cox on cybersecurity. So we are learning as we go along how the conference is developing, but we highly recommend it. It's, as I say, been going on since right after 2011. Thanks to John Piper and to all of you for being with us. We hope you will come back next week, when we will have another exciting episode of the Science News Radio Network program, Promise of Tomorrow. Okay, and stay tuned, because just ahead we have the voice of reason. Andrew Pennington is giving us a word of wisdom today. And to take us there, back again with the Science News Radio Network studio band. Thank you. this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to the this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
Don't make your decisions based on fear. There's so many things we can be afraid of, and fear elicits a fight or flight response, and sometimes it also creates a freeze response. And we're seeing freeze right now in the development of our laws. We're seeing fright in the development of these systems. And what we really need to do is identify what the benefit is, what the advantage is of the systems, and figure out where we want these autonomous systems in our life. I am much, much more concerned about the intrusiveness of surveillance systems or electronics being integrated with humankind over the next 20 to 30 years as we develop new embedded technologies. Colonel Andrew Pennington, serving in the United States Air Force Reserves as individual mobilization augmentee to the Director of Air and Cyberspace Operations, Pacific Air Forces, and also Gartner Executive Partner in my civilian role, serving as advisor to federal chief information officers.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
We live tomorrow, 'cause you know it will be there. I am waiting for you. I am waiting for you.